Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Hey kids, welcome to Grumpy Nostalgia, the Second Look Cinema Podcast, the show where we go back to the blockbuster new release wall of our memories, grab a copy off the shelf, pop it in the old VCR, and see what time has done to it. I'm Justin, that's Mike.
Wake up, it's time to die.
And we're here to help you navigate all the landmines littered down memory lane. So Mike, we're back to a duo again.
Yeah, I miss Molly already.
Yeah. So for those that aren't aware, I checked some of our older episodes. We were joined by Molly, one of our listeners on the last show, and that was a lot of fun. So we'd love to do that again. So if you guys want to sit in on the show, send us a direct message on our Instagram account, and it's just that easy. But we're back to grumpy old guys again. You and I, Mike.
Yes, sir. Sorry, audience.
You have to deal with us and without Molly's fresh takes. We wanted to get right back in the groove here, and we decided we want to go way back in the Wayback Machine. We were a little embarrassed by the age gap on the last show, so we're just going to stay in our comfort zone. And we're going all the way back to 1982, Mike.
Wow, 40 years. 41 years now. Hey, check that out. It's a new year, Justin. Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year to you. All right, so we're going to cover Blade Runner, the science fiction cult classic. We're going to talk about pending disaster that it was and how it was almost impossible that this thing got made. It's all up there on the screen, Mike. It's quite a unique movie. And we're going to kind of get into the mythology of it, and we're going to get to the background, how it was made, and we'll kind of go through the plot, just like we usually do. This one's more interesting than most. It's an interesting story how this got from print to screen, so we'll get into that.
Cool.
All right. So having said all that nonsense, let's get right to it. So this was directed by Ridley Scott, who a lot of people know from Alien and the Apple Macintosh commercial. Remember that? 1984?
Oh, yeah.
He directed that. He also did Thelma and Louise and quite a few other ones. But as of late, he's kind of fallen into a bit of a slump, I would call it, Mike. He's done some Dogs. Most recent, I think, was House of Gucci, which was left a little to be desired.
Let's don't talk about the Alien ones.
Alien Covenant, Prometheus, just really didn't live up to expectations from a lot of people. But we'll get into more of that later. That was written by a guy named Hampton Fancher, who did 10 drafts. Of this just indicative of how hard this movie was to get to the screen. It's adapted from a Philip K. Dick novel, Do Androids Dream Electric Sheep? We've covered several of his short stories to adaptations on our show already, Mike. Our most favorite and most recent being Total Recall.
Right. Oh. Yeah. Cohagen.
Cohagen. Quado. but as Hampton Fancher was the original screenwriter, he turned out about 10 drafts, had quite a bit of confrontation with the rest of the production crew, kind of quit, and they brought in a guy named David Webb Peoples to rewrite the script. These guys actually ended up knowing each other and collaborating a lot together, but there's a little bit of animosity there, obviously, at first. But David Webb Peoples, we might know him from Unforgiven, Mike, and 12 Monkeys.
Okay.
So he's kind of in that genre. So this was released in June 25th, 1982, on a budget of $25 million.
Okay, I'm going to show my ignorance here.
Yeah.
Was this before or after Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I think this was after.
Okay. Yeah, so Raiders. Yeah. So Harrison Ford was already kind of riding that. Yeah. I know Empire Strikes Back, obviously, but then it's funny because that was the first thing I was thinking of watching this movie and seeing it was 1982 was, I wonder if this was, because that was like his breakout kind of movie. And, I was wondering if Blade Runner was something he was already on contract to do before Raiders, and he just happened to be, or is this something he wanted to do? But anyway, that's a tangent we'll probably go over here in a second.
Yeah, so whatever he was up to, he was on a streak. You know, he had Empire Strikes Back, and he had in 80, he had in 81, he had Raiders of the Lost Ark, in 82, he had Blade Runner. So 83, he had Return of the Jedi. So I think 84, he had Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom. So, I mean, the guy... Let's just say the guy was on a winning streak. So this had a $25 million budget, but what was more interesting about this budget is how it came to be. About 5 days before principal photography, the studio pulled $15 million from the principal budget and reallocated it to a movie called Blowout, Mike, which I think you talked about.
Oh, yeah. John Travolta and Brian De Palma at their best.
So it took some last minute 11th hour financing just to get the darn thing made.
Wow.
It was a... quite contentious, and that's just the start. But
it's funny. I saw Bud Yorkin as one of the producers, and I remember him from doing a lot of TV shows like Sanford and Sons and such like that. I was like, what is he? It was funny. His hand was involved in this movie. You know, about science fiction.
Hook or crook was the methodology on getting this thing made.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but we'll kind of get in it. One of the more difficult things was finding a director and finding a cast. So, Mike, the cast at the time was, you know, with one notable exception, relatively packed with unknowns, but they all have become iconic status. So walk us through the cast.
Yeah, it's funny when you say that. Like, obviously, everybody knows Harrison Ford, but the rest of the cast, this was their big movie, you know. And you think of some of these people, and you're like, oh yeah, they were in Blade Runner. They were in Blade, you know. Yeah. I think first and foremost would be Sean Young, who, you know, I knew her from this movie, and then Dune, I believe, the other science fiction movie came to mind. But her most famous movie for me was Ace Ventura, where she played the transsexual field goal kicker for the Miami Dolphins.
Laces out.
Which was really, really a funny role to remember her for. Yeah. But she had, it's just funny because I don't like looking these people up, but it was bugging me when I was watching this movie because I remembered her as having a reputation of almost getting this role or almost getting that role. So, of course, I did a small little dive and cheated by going online here. I thought it was funny that she was almost Marion Ravenswood in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right, yeah.
And she was almost Catwoman in Batman Returns. And she was almost Vicki Vale in the first Tim Burton Batman movie, which is kind of cool. And she was this close, my fingers are about an inch apart, to being Tess Trueheart in Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy movie. But apparently either she had conflict with some of the male leads on these movies or vice versa. It's a little hazy. I don't know if it's her personality that kind of rubs people the wrong way or, like I said, Hollywood in the 80s was a little tougher than it is nowadays. So maybe it was partially different town
for women, especially eccentric women. You know, there's the legend that she auditioned for the Catwoman role in full costume.
I read that. Yeah. She made the mistake of appearing on TV and different couple talk shows in costume. It was like, you shouldn't have done that, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, and her, like I said, this for me, you know, this was her big deal movie was being in Blade Runner. And after
she
just faded into a lot of independent, you know, B or Z grade movies. And then you had Daryl Hannah, who don't know if this was her first big picture, but her role is pretty minor in this movie. And I'm going on the fact that, you know, spoilers, this is the first time I ever saw this movie. And I always thought she had a bigger role in the movie because I remember seeing clips of her in her little weird black, you know, raccoonish makeup she wore in this movie. And, she's got a lot bigger after this from Splash and numerous other movies like Legal Eagles and Kill Bill, you know. Now she's Mrs. Neil Young, so, you know, everybody knows Daryl Hannah. She plays one of the replicants in this movie, along with the big baddie who's Rutger Hauer, who, again, you say Rutger Hauer, you think Blade Runner, you know. Another one of those guys that's in a lot of grade B movies. And the only other movie I could think of him in before this one was about the same time was Nighthawks, which is a really underrated Sylvester Stallone movie where he's kind of the baddie terrorist guy in New York, and it's an awesome movie. And he's one of the big bad replicant. Then you have Harrison Ford. Okay, he's the lead, and he's our Blade Runner character. He's a cop who's trained to hunt down a replicant. There's some of it's kind of an expository a la like a film noir Humphrey Bogart kind of movie, and it's kind of cool the way he's portrayed as a hardened detective. And I couldn't think of, you know, like we were just talking about him being an action star. It was kind of hard for me to see him as a hardball detective, but it works in this movie. And he's joined by a couple familiar faces of people like M. Emmett Walsh, who you're like, I know this guy from a lot of stuff, you know. And you have Edward James Olmos, who's kind of a cop that's, he's really weird in this movie. I can't even describe his role.
You remember every scene he's in.
He's a good cop and bad cop at the same time, but he's this guy that's, you know, speaks in this weird language and He's obviously a replicant, maybe, but he was much better in movies like Stand and Deliver and TV roles like Miami Vice. And I think everyone would know him from Battlestar Galactica. You know, that's his deal. Then there were a couple of smaller characters that are way down the list. There's a guy I mentioned a couple week times ago in one of our podcasts, James Hong, who,
oh yeah,
I swear to God, this guy's been in more movies than anybody, Asian, American, European, African, you name it. This guy's been in more movies. And Larry from Newhart, not Daryl or his other brother Daryl, but actual Larry was in this movie, who I was glad to see. And then we had two podcast alumni in this movie, and I hope you picked both of them out. There were Brian James, who was one of the replicants, who also appeared in Fifth Element, another weird science fiction movie. And then you had Joe Turkel, who is Tyrell in this movie, kind of the big corporate baddie, who also had appeared in one of his only other kind of iconic roles in The Shining as the bartender in that.
Lloyd.
Yeah, Lloyd
right?
And it was good to see him again. I was like, oh my gosh, there he is. I didn't even know he was in this movie until I watched it. And I was like, again, he's one of those iconic characters you didn't know from like one or two movies. And this one was it. So that was pretty much your cast. And
this is
very eclectic.
It's a character actor's masterpiece, masterclass, right? Everybody in here has a unique character trait or some sort of weird look or a steam ceiling, you know, ability. Everyone was just great. Some other notes on that cast. Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott really hated each other for several reasons. One, it was a very grueling shoot. If you notice, every scene outdoors is raining. That made tempers flare. Harrison Ford hated the narration. In the original script, there wasn't as much expository narration. He hated all that voiceover. And he also hated the fact that he was supposed to wear a hat. It sounds petty at this point, but you kind of understand. He didn't want to wear a hat. That's why he got that weird haircut, so the hat wouldn't fit.
Oh, my gosh. But he would that's his iconic fashion style from Razor Wild Stark.
How these things kind of work out,
right? So weird.
Philip K. Dick had an opportunity to see about 20 minutes of pre-production footage before he passed away during the shooting. Man. And he was amazed by it, and he was completely overwhelmed by the casting, and just loved what he saw.
Was this his first story put to film?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I want to say yes.
I haven't done a deep dive on it to know, but I was kind of curious to see if he had gotten kind of famous outside of the writer world, from this
point. Right. There was a tremendous amount of pressure from the studio on Ridley Scott. He was fired a couple times on this shoot. Went over budget. There's creative differences. There's seven different versions of this film, like director's cuts, final cut. It was just a really chaotic shoot, a really chaotic post-production, really chaotic release, and a really chaotic legacy, and we'll kind of get to that too. It came out on the same weekend as E.T. and The Thing.
Oh my gosh.
So that, how's that for three movies in a row? The success of E.T. obviously kind of crushed The Thing and Blade Runner. Those two movies had, really hamstrung their box office. And fortunately for both those, they kind of ultimately kind of grew into cult status films. And we'll kind of get into that a little bit more. But the original cut was also 4 hours long, which the studio was not happy about either. So how this movie ever got released is beyond me. Even things as simple as the soundtrack. They actually hired Pete Townsend from The Who to do the soundtrack, Mike. But he declined because he had such a horrible experience doing the same thing for the movie Tommy. So they replaced him with the John Rhys-Davies doppelganger Vangelis.
This was after Chariots of Fire, I'm assuming, and got a lot of pop after that.
Yeah, but they finally figured out who they could hire to be in it. They finally got a director. They finally got a studio that would support it, and they finally settled down on a script and cranked out what would ultimately become, after about 20 or 30 years, one of the gold standards for science fiction. But it did not get there easily, and we'll kind of get there. So in 1982, Mike, it came out. Movie tickets were $3 back then, as you remember. Other things going on in 1982 that I thought were interesting. The Journey song, Open Arms, was the number one song during the release here. Journey, Mike.
Journey.
That song was so big that a small little independent video game company worked with Journey to produce the Atari game Journey Escape.
Yeah.
Remember that one?
I remember the pinball machine too. They had a special Journey Escape pinball.
The game was so horrible and sales was so terrible that it ultimately bankrupted the video game studio, which I thought was funny. The World's Fair in Knoxville, Tennessee was going on at the same time. They left the city of Knoxville, Tennessee $46 million in debt. And the World's Fair actually turned a $57 profit, Mike. $57.
Oh, well, they still have that big gold ball tower there, so that's good.
Yes, they do.
There's a legacy.
Yes. You don't talk about the World's Fair much anymore, do we?
No, it's kind of gone away with the hula hoop.
Yeah. Ronald Reagan and George Bush were in the White House. The musical Cats opened up on Broadway this year. CD players started being sold in Japan. And the board game Trivial Pursuit was released in 1982. We were drinking our Bartles and James, as you remember, Mike. That's the year those came out.
That's two old farts. I hated those commercials.
They kind of look like us now, though.
I know.
And this was the final season of the CBS Mystery Theater television show, hosted by President E.G. Marshall and his horrendous wig.
His wig. I'm gonna start making that my handle in somewhere. I gotta go on like Twitter or Tumblr and start doing hashtag EG Marshall's wig. Yes. I love it.
So that's kind of where we were. I think you and I were just little tykes, barely hit our teenage years. But
yes,
my first watch on this, Mike, was not till I think the first time I saw this was in 1992 in the theater. Yeah, it was one of those things that just kind of skipped me by, and I saw it, and let's face it, this movie's kind of a slow burn, and the first time I saw it, I was like, I didn't want to dislike it, because it felt like something I should like, you know, that's kind of the feeling I had about it, but,
right.
Yeah, and you mentioned the first time you saw this movie was today ago, so.
Yeah, I'd actually saw the, it was funny, because I saw the Blade Runner 2049, or whatever it's called.
Oh, yeah?
You know, a couple of years ago, right after it came out, and I had seen scenes from the original. You know, like I said, there's very iconic imagery, like the moving billboards, the flying cars, Daryl Hannah flipping over and over again, and then you know, Rutger Hauer, and a lot of rain. And but other than that, it was one that, like you say, it was one of those movies where I feel like, okay, this is important. This is important cinema right here. I need to study this and watch this because it's supposed to be really good.
Well, it invented a lot of stuff that have eventually become tropes. It essentially started the cyberpunk genre. So anyway, it's 1982. We're in the theater, and I think we're ready to start. Mike, you ready?
I'm ready. Got my popcorn.
Hit the button. So what I like best about the way this movie starts is you get that large boom, that cinematic boom, and the screen's just black. And that was deliberate. They wanted to have the credits be just simple text on a black screen because they knew that they had what was going to be one of the most iconic opening shots in movie history. And they were right. After about 2 minutes of like prologue and stuff like that, they kind of give you a little story about what the replicants are. And there's been this rebellion. Replicants are essentially androids that are with increased AI, and they go on amok and they have a little rebellion off world and start turning on their masters, and Blade Runners are an elite cop force that are designed to identify them and take them out. Not kill them, but what was the term, Mike? Retire.
Retire, yeah. The Nexus 6 replicants were supposed to retire after their certain amount of time,
Right. So as that prologue on the screen in text kind of goes away, you get this amazing opening shot, establishing shot of Los Angeles in 2019. You know, 3 years ago. But it's shot at night, and you get that, you know, you get the entire the pillars of fire coming up. It's just an amazing scene. It really showcases the letterbox format. It is one of the movies that really pushed distribution companies to push the letterbox format.
And you have that you have that dreamy planetarium kind of Vangelis music, you know.
Yeah,
like you're sitting there listening to music from the Laserium.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but think of the opening to Pod People. It was just for a second. Right. Then, like you said, the imagery kind of takes over from there. You see the landscape of LA and how bleak it is.
So right away, you've seen something you've never seen before, and you know you're in for at least something visually that's just going to be extremely unique, and you're right. So it kind of cuts to one of the replicants is getting interviewed at the Tyrell organization. Leon Kowalski, Mike, is the name.
Yes.
which sounds like somebody I used to know back in the Chicago area. That sounds like a great name there. They have this methodology they use called the Voight-Kampff test, where they ask a series of questions to initiate an emotional response, and they're supposed to identify if you're a replicant or not. So he starts asking about this turtle. it's not going well, and then the questioner asks a question about his mother, and he doesn't like that.
It
and
really doesn't go like, well,
yeah. Yeah, that's a trigger.
And combat boots or something. I couldn't quite remember.
So he ends up shooting and killing the interviewer, and so we establish that these guys they're not good people. And then it kind of cuts to this kind of rainy street in Los Angeles, and we get introduced to Harrison Ford playing Rick Deckard, who only goes by his surname in this. He's called Deckard.
Yeah.
And he's eating noodles at a rainy outdoor cafe, and then he gets interrupted by Edward James Olmos.
What's with the weird language they're speaking? Do you know anything about that? Like, what are they trying to establish with that?
I think they're trying to establish that the world has become this giant multicultural thing. There's like one language across.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like
it's like a blending and melding of cultures and stuff. It just kind of come to fruition. It's all just like one big world population.
I gotcha. So, it's like the language they were trying to push on us in the 80s. Wasn't it? Oh no.
The new math,
yeah, it was something like that. Then there was a language that we're supposed to like eventually everyone assimilate to.
Piglet.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Was it Piglet? I knew it.
Exactly.
But anyway, Edward James almost says he interrupts his noodles and says, "Hey, you need to come with us. Commissioner wants to talk to him." And of course, like in every other cop detective story, he wants nothing to do it, but he gets pulled in there. So he ends up going back to the police station. We meet Commissioner Bryant, who's played by Emmett Walsh.
Love his office. The throwback, like, 1950s or 60s looking office is great.
But he kind of lays down some exposition to Harrison Ford. He says, look, we've got, there's this huge rebellion off world. And I think six replicants got loose. Two of them got killed going through an electric fence, but they're on their way to, for some reason, they came back to Earth to go to the Tyrell Corporation, which is the genetic company that manufactures the replicants. So there's four that are still loose, Leon, Roy, Zora, and Pris. Leon is the guy that shot up the poor interviewer earlier. Roy is played by Rutger Hauer. And is he not just like the prototype villain, man? One of my biggest takeaways from this movie is how awesome Rutger Hauer is. I mean, what a role. Yeah,
almost almost charming and just pure evil at the same time. It's like perfect mix.
Yeah, and there's two females. One's named Zora, who's kind of like this multifunctional assassin. Another one named is Pris, who's played by, as Mike mentioned, Daryl Hannah, one of her earlier roles, and she's a pleasure model, Mike. So just like we are.
I was looking up that language as Esperanto in case anyone was scratching their heads. Okay. Yes, because it was a language that was going to be tried and going to be our kind of like what Edward James Olmos was speaking of.
Yeah.
Around the same time in our history, around the early 80s, it was a language that was supposedly going to be spoken by everyone.
Yeah. I just vaguely remember that.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, Captain Bryant's really is pleading with the old Blade Runner, Rick Deckard, to say, you got to help us. This is a really bad one. You know, and once a cop, always a cop. So he agrees to take on the case. So as a condition of that, the commissioner tells, before he does anything, he wants you to go to the Tyrell Corporation because they've got a new Model 6 prototype that they may be able to understand some clues on how these things function. So Harrison Ford goes over to the Tyrell organization. And he meets Rachel, one of the assistants to James Tyrell, who's the president and square glassed owner of the company. Really, really weird, creepy looking guy. He wants to test that Voight-Kampff test. He wants to perform it on a replicant. And Tyrell says, "Well, why don't you try it on Rachel first?" And so we get this interesting scene. Just the lighting of the scene and everything was really cool, and the smoking and
the smoking in this movie is crazy.
Yeah, a lot of
smoking. I had no idea 2019 LA there had been so many smokers. It was amazing.
Like big giant cigarettes.
You know, yeah, this whole thing. This is kind of, I'm going to go on off a little tangent, but I had the same vibe watching this movie that I did watching Predator 2, as far as them trying to almost create a universe that's futuristic but anachronistic at the same time, where it has you know, even in this movie, you have flying cars, you have moving billboards, glow stick umbrellas, but you also have people wearing like World War One flying ace helmets or like old football hats and cars that have gull wings on them, you know, like the DeLorean. It was like, it was just weird. And then like I even said with like the police captain's office and and then all
the could have been right out of the 30s, but it's a dystopian future. It's really
and then
weird,
the smoking. Yeah. Like I said, that's probably the most anachronistic element of all was just the you know, the smoking. Like in Predator 2, you had the the Jamaicans with the gigantic reefers, and here it was just gigantic cigarettes. You know, everybody's on either on a filter or not. And it was like just oh my goodness. But like they said that. The smoky lighting and everything in darkness kind of added to that.
The atmospheric of it is just, it's very atmospheric, very, very cool. Yeah. So he performs this test on her, and then she's excused, and Tyrell says, well, what do you think? Decker says, well, she's a replicant. He says, very good. But usually it takes about 20 questions. It took about 100 with her, and Deckard replies, well, she doesn't know she is one. And that's where the story kind of gets complex, because it's introduced here that they've, in an effort to increase the iteration, to upgrade the replicants, they've actually implanted memories in them. So it gets interesting here. We get introduced here to Ray Batty, who is played by Rutger Hauer. And he's back on Earth, and he's trying to figure out a way to get to the Tyrell organization. So he ends up kind of like strong arming himself into this eyeball dealer who creates eyeballs, and played by Mike's hero, James Hong.
Yes.
They kind of like interrogate him and figure out ways to get to James Tyrell. And this guy kind of gives everybody up, and he sends him to this guy named J.F. Sebastian. And J.F. Sebastian is this young genetic, I think a genetic designer. So they kind of go to his house next. So in the meantime, Deckard goes back to Kowalski's apartment looking for clues, and he sees a bunch of photos, and he sees like this little scale, animal scale, and that's the clue to the next part of the movie. So
yeah, they're zooming in. The photograph technology was light years ahead of about anything I've ever seen. Jeez whiz.
Yeah, so to Mike's point, he finds this animal scale, and it's implied that in the future the animals aren't around anymore. They're all kind of artificially made. And the scale has a small little serial number on it that he takes to an office in Los Angeles. They do an analysis and say, this is a snake scale. And he takes it back to his apartment. He starts looking at the photos in Kowalski's apartment. He sees, in the background of one of the images, he sees like a reflection of something. And this is one of the greatest enhanced scenes to Mike's point. He's got a little computer. He can put the photo in, and it kind of blows up the screen, and we get to see in the photo it's Zora, and he sees that she's got like this snake tattoo. So he starts to put two and two together, and ends up going to a nightclub and sees Zora, who's played by Joanna Cassidy, who's a stripper. And he starts to interrogate her, and of course she's too smart for that, and she ends up really beating the crap out of him. And there's this big street chase, and he ends up like shooting her in the middle of the street. And as he kills her, he takes out the first replicant, but also, Leon sees this happen too. And he starts, he's not pleased about that. So he's in the background, but he says that, it got personal now. So Detective Brian kind of shows up to help clean up the first replicant being killed. They kind of clean up the scene. And, he tells, Harrison Ford that, hey, good job. You only got four more to go. And Harrison Ford's, wait, no, there's three. He says, no, now there's four, because we need to go kill. We need to go kill the Rachel, because she's gone rogue. So just like that, he's got to kill this person he just met. So as he's on his way back to his apartment, Leon kind of gets him in a dark hallway and starts throwing him around the street. And one of my favorite things in movie history, Mike, is Leon grabs Harrison Ford and like picks him up and says, "How old am I?" And then Harrison Ford just punches him in the face as hard as he can, and then he says, "I don't know."
Pretty good.
But so the scene kind of concludes with Leon just beating the crap out. Harrison Ford takes a real beating in this movie, and he ends up like smacking him around to the point of a consciousness, and he kind of slaps his face and says this iconic line, Mike. You want to
Oh,
what is
it? It was the wake. Oh, yeah, I already started off with it. It was the wake up time to die.
Yeah. So as he's ready to kill Harrison Ford, Rachel appears off screen and shoots Leon. So,
what do you think? What is he saying? Okay. All right, audience. This is where Justin and I go off on a slight tangent. So enjoy
another one.
Okay. Watching this movie from the future, looking back, I know about the theories on whether Deckard is a replicant or whatnot. When he says, that's the first thing I noticed when I was watching this movie was, okay, he says, wake up to him. He wasn't knocked out. He wasn't out. Just the fact that he said that line, wake up, time to die. Is he implying to Deckard, wake up from your, dream that you think you're human and you're really a replicant? Or am I reading way too much into this? Because I know I haven't done the deep dive on this, but I know there's theories out there about Deckard being a replicant, and people thinking from watching this movie you can kind of get that idea. And I didn't know if this is part of that whole, like, you know, I buried Paul kind of theory or not. If I'm saying wake up, you know what I mean? Am I reading too much into some of this, or what's the main theory behind why Deckard is considered to be a replicant?
Well, the 40-year legacy of this movie is the ambiguity among film historians whether, you know, Harrison Ford is a replicant or not.
Yeah.
And I decided for the purposes of this podcast, I didn't care.
Right.
I think the ambiguity, there's always a need for people to need to know why.
Yeah.
And
right,
especially, again, I want to get generational, I don't care, but as generations go on, they don't accept that kind of ambiguity anymore, you know? And
well,
you got to know why. And it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, I'm looking at this from, you know, 2023. That was one of the things I loved about Inception, was you never really, did you ever, it was DiCaprio in a dream the whole time or not?
Yeah.
And it was left ambiguous. For that reason, so people could talk and talk. Was Tony Soprano and his family killed at the end of the Soprano? You know, was it at the end of the episode? And no one knows, but you can talk about.
That's where I take umbrage. I'm gonna play both. I'm gonna talk out both sides of my mouth.
Okay.
I think when it's done well, ambiguity is a great plot device.
Right.
I think it, but more often than not, and I think the Soprano, just to me personally, I could be wrong. I probably am. Just to me personally, I always felt, not to be antagonistic, but I always thought the Sopranos ending was the worst ending in TV history.
I got you.
And it's not because, as a screenwriter, a movie is one thing. You got 100 minutes to tell a story. But, you know, the Sopranos had, what, how many seasons? 4, 5, 6, 7 seasons to establish a story arc. If you can't end the story and you make the audience kind of figure it out on your own, I just think that, I thought that was a cop-out.
Well,
so
yeah. Well, I'm not here to defend it. I think, I think I'm just talking about the buzz. You talk about Blade Runner's been talked about for 40 years, and it's still being talked about for that particular issue, and that's what's kind of increased its I can't even think of the word, but you know what I mean? It's kind of helped to form the mythos around it even more. I mean, I don't think it would be as big a movie as if there were, I mean, that was, if you watch the Blade Runner 2049, I mean, it's obvious by when you watch that movie, he's a human. And it's like, they put it to bed right there. But I guess in The Sopranos, it was ambiguous, but had everybody talking that Monday about it, or in the week,
months afterwards. But the reason they were talking, because it was a gimmick. The ambiguity in this one is woven into the plot. So we can go on for days.
It's woven into the plot, but I don't think it was meant to be ambiguous.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I think people read so much into it afterwards. That's what I'm saying. It's kind of one of the, I buried Paul. Wizard of Oz played same time as
Pink Floyd.
I mean, it's the one that just, these are things that have come after the movie was made. And I think the same thing happened with this movie. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it when glasses that say, hey, he might be a replicant. So when he says, wake up, time to die. Ooh, wow, there's a breadcrumb. Look at that. You know, and it probably isn't. I don't think it may have been a throwaway line, you know.
Well, what's personal about movies is just that, you know, it's the man on the moon thing. If you look for the man on the moon, you'll find one.
Right. And I think the fact that these tracks have been laid by people that say, hey, he could be a replicant, you know. And,
yeah.
And when I'm, like I said, for somebody like me watching this for the first time, I'm like, oh,
yeah,
ooh, okay, this is intriguing. It made it more intriguing to me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We'll talk about this after, you know, on our little review at the end. But I have some feelings that probably differ from what other people would think of this movie. Okay. So anyway,
well, I can't wait to get there. So just to bookend the replicant thing. So as Harrison Ford comes back from all this trauma, he sees that Rachel's in his apartment, or she confronts him about the results of the test, and he very impersonally just says, "Yeah, you're a replicant," and she fights him because she doesn't know what she is either. And then, you know, she's trying to defend that she's not based on the memories. And he kind of counters, but I know what your memories are. And he kind of explains them to her. He says, they're not your memories. They're Tyrell's nieces. They were implanted in you. Hmm. And that's a huge thing for someone to take on. So she takes on that news with some real empathy. And, you know, those tears that she's crying are real by Sean Young. It's a very emotional scene. It kind of cuts through the sci-fi and the film noir and just kind of cuts into some humanity, which I thought was a neat little thing, but they ultimately kind of form a relationship. So,
right.
So as that's happening, Pris, who is one of the replicants played by Daryl Hannah, locates the JF Sebastian. He's got progeria or something like that, Mike. He's got like an accelerated aging disease.
Methuselah or something.
Methuselah syndrome.
Yeah. I didn't know if that was a real thing or not.
I think it was kind of symbolism because, you know, they put a failsafe into these replicants, so they only have a 4-year lifespan, and they become sentient and they've understood that, you know, they have to figure out a way to get more life, and they're trying to figure out a way to get to the people that created them to figure out a way to survive.
Is he an idiot savant and he's just been like given this building by Tyrell just to stay there, and Tyrell is just using his genetic material to create his replicant so they have a short life?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I didn't know if he was actually doing science. He said he created a couple of his little, like, you know, smallish friends there, like the Kaiser guy.
So as J.F. Sebastian's, you know, coming home to his building, you know, Daryl Hannah's kind of out in the middle of the street, and she's kind of like left destitute, and she gives him they kind of spook each other, and she kind of runs off and kind of smashes into a car. And this is real, Mike. Shattered her elbow in a couple places. Actually her running into that car. So she's got two souvenirs. One, she kept the wig from this movie, and she also got like this huge scar in her left elbow. But she appeals to his generosity and goes upstairs. And Sebastian's got an interesting little menagerie of like weird robot pets that he's made. It was real nightmare fuel. But he's made a bunch of little toys that are, you know, semi AI. You know, the importance here is that it's kind of the same thing. He created these replicants essentially the same way. So as she kind of develops a bond with Sebastian, what she's really trying to do is coordinate a meeting with Roy Rutger Hauer. And he ends up coming in and meeting with her and meeting with Sebastian. And, they kind of use Sebastian to get them inside Tyrell Industries. At this point, they confront the owner, James Tyrell, and explain that they call him father, which is creepy.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a Frankenstein thing where they come back and they understand the limitations of their life and they want more. And then Tyrell explains to them that they were designed to not be able to get that. Yeah. And then it doesn't end up good for either one of them. Rutger Hauer kind of takes James Tyrell's head and just crushes it like a grape, which is pretty gruesome. And then unfortunately they take out little Sebastian too. So as news of this gets out and there's an APB put out for all the detectives that they've got to get to explore what has happened here and investigate the murder scene, Deckard goes to Sebastian's apartment to look for clues, and Pris is there, and they start fighting, this was a crazy fight too. She's got some serious thighs of death.
Oh yeah, that was pretty good.
She's quite the gymnast, and she kind of like does a little flying zucchini brother and gets his head in her thighs and just almost pops it off. She ends up getting shot ultimately by Deckard, and that noise brings Roy in, and Roy was in love with Pris, and Roy's on the edge anyway. Rutger Hauer, he's crazed, and but when he sees her lifeless body on the on the floor, he kind of goes into beast mode. And he just gets this crazed look on his eye and just kind of, they had this amazing violent fight. Where he just pulverizes Harrison Ford for about 20 minutes. And do you notice, Mike, there's 20 minutes here where Harrison Ford has no dialogue.
Yeah, there's a lot of grunting and, like, repairing his fingers and that, but yeah, there's nothing.
But there's this huge fight between him and Rutger Hauer. Well, it's not really a fight. It's mostly just Rutger Hauer throwing him around, inflicting pain. But what's interesting here is that Rutger Hauer knows that his life is ticking away, and he's starting to degrade. Each scene, he loses a little bit less of his faculties. And it kind of culminates with Harrison Ford being, he's trying to escape, and he's like hanging by broken fingers on this ledge of the building. Rutger Hauer kind of looks over him. And like I said, he's the last sand is in the hourglass at this point, but he's looking at him with this crazed look. And in this act of defiance, which I thought I never noticed before, but was really cool, Harrison Ford just spits at him rather than concede, and he just drops.
Yeah.
And then Rutger Hauer grabs him with his incredible enhanced strength and just pulls him over and does this really kind of heartbreaking monologue about, you know, trying to be sympathetic. And he actually comes across, he was made a slave, and he had seen all these horrible things.
Yeah.
And he's telling all this to Harrison Ford, you know, to kind of, you know, piggyback on that theme. Maybe are they both replicants, or, you know, what is he trying to confess, or is it a warning, or is it a confession, or is it a, you know, but he ends up dying without, you know, he just kind of expires, and Harrison Ford just kind of doesn't know what to really do. So you think the movie's kind of over there, but as the rest of the Blade Runner crew show up,
they have great timing, don't they?
They sure, like always. Yeah. Edward James almost kind of takes them back to his apartment, and he's onto it. He kind of knows that, that Rachel needs to be taken out, but he kind of just doesn't really engage, you know? And then he has this amazing line. He goes, it's too bad she won't live, but then again, who does? And that's the last line of the movie. It's just a very, very clever ending, kind of anticlimactic, kind of bittersweet, I guess is the word. The replicants are taken out, but it's implied that Harrison Ford, rather than kill Rachel, takes off with her, and then that they kind of fade to black.
They just go into an elevator. But he does. Yeah, I mean, I don't. Okay. I know there's we're probably gonna get into this, but there's several different versions of this movie, but. Was that an ending that was added where he goes back to his apartment and they both, he asks her, does he trust her, or does she trust him? And she's like, yeah. Do you love me? Yeah. And then they both run away into the elevator. And he's going to the elevator.
There's several.
There's versions, like the origami of a unicorn on the ground outside his apartment. Meaning that must have been where Olmos was standing or keeping watch on his apartment or whatnot. It was kind of interesting.
Yep. Like I mentioned, there's literally seven different versions of this film that are released, and they're all the changes are subtle enough to mean a little bit of difference. There's some extra scenes added here and there, but it's mostly to reinforce the ambiguity of whether he's a replicant or not. So it's hard to say what movie you're watching and how to form an opinion of it. But the most recent one, the one that me and Mike watched, that's currently on Hulu, or we're going to go off that one. So.
Okay,
I'm sure our listening audience has other takes on this, but they don't have a podcast, and we do.
I'm like I say, just for it, to me, after watching I'm going to say sequel in air quotes. After watching that, it was I feel like the ambiguity was taken away from it enough for me.
I haven't seen the movie, but I've read the opposite. I've read the fact that
made it.
I guess
more.
I have to watch. So let's go into some more awards and accolades. So this was not well received by critics or the viewing public. Very low box office. It only opened to $6 million. It ended up making $32 million domestically and about $41 million worldwide. But I think over time, I think it's obvious that this has become one of the most iconic science fiction movies of all time. Over time, it through a cult following, at least if nothing else. It got nominated for a couple Oscars, visual effects and art direction. I think those are absolutely no-brainers. Those kind of the aesthetics of this movie have had a huge influence on so many people over the years. It really highly influenced Christopher Nolan, Guillermo del Toro, for example. These guys use this as their masterclass in cinematography and set design. As we mentioned earlier, the cyberpunk genre was essentially credited to this movie. As Mike mentioned, there was a sequel in Blade Runner 2049, released in 2017. It kind of picks up where the previous plot leaves off. I haven't seen it, but I'm looking forward to checking that one out.
Yeah, it's it has the same, you know, tone. It has the same almost atmospheric. It's very well mimicked as far as the Ridley Scott version, but it's
right.
There's no soul to it. It really is gone as far as from me watching the two. You know, if I was going to compare the two, there's definitely more of a coldness or a blankness to the sequel.
Well, it's got Ana de Armas in it, so I would watch her read the phone book, so I'll check that out anyway. All right, and I think there's actually an Amazon series in development called Blade Runner 2099 that will pick up where the story left off. So we have that coming up next. Let's go for the grumpy meter here, right? So this will be kind of an altered grumpy meter because of the conditions in which you saw it. But my first time seeing it was at the Revival Theater in Chicago. And it was the 20th anniversary or something like that edition. And I'd see my first view was on the big screen in an old art house theater. And I was just really impressed. It's a slow burn. I actually dozed off a couple times, but I realized that I like the fact that I saw it in the theater on the big screen, the big wide screen, in the way it was probably meant to be seen. And like I mentioned before, it's slow. It's pretty. It was more film noir than I expected. But I probably only gave it like a 2.5 out of 5, but, watching again, this weekend, as a much older, grumpier guy, I really ramped up my appreciation for it. There were layers here that I didn't pick up. There's hidden context that was revealed, the atmospheric part of it. There's so much more that I noticed this time as a more well-versed film goer. And I just really enjoyed it. Even on a 15-inch laptop screen, I just really was taken away from the world for a while. So I probably bumped it up to a 4 out of 5. So it was just I really enjoyed it more as an older guy. So, Mike, you probably can't do the same kind of comparative analysis, but walk us through your take on it.
I'm younger Justin watching the 20th anniversary of it, I think. That and the fact I probably watched it a little too late at night, you know. It was almost somnambulistic to me to watch it. I felt myself kind of dozing off, and at times it was almost too atmospheric and too I can't even imagine watching a longer version of this, but it had had such a buildup in my mind over time, and I knew it was a movie that influenced like Brazil and Fifth Element, Total Recall, Westworld. I mean,
it's a great movie that'll put you to sleep.
It's weird. Exactly. This is where I come to the Dr. Jekyll part of my review and say, you know, it was brilliantly done, and you know, I can't fault it for that. It's a fabulous movie, and like I say, it's leaps and bounds better than the sequel I watched. And I had too much expectation watching it, and I shouldn't have. And I think that's part of the problem. But I'm also the same guy who gets disappointed watching 2001 because it's too talky. You know, what does that like 20 lines of dialogue? But it's like, I guess I'm looking for too much action in movies now. I don't know. But it was really well done. You know, like the characters are almost too quirky now that I'm looking at it, but I'm looking at it through glasses that should have seen it 40 years ago instead of seeing it now. Right, and I kind of wish I did, because I would be defending it with all my heart right now if I had seen this movie originally. I would be like, this movie's, and it is a good movie. I would say if I was going to rate it out of 5 stars, it's still a 3.5, but it's just kind of not what I thought it was. And I'm, like I said, I'm going at that as a fan of science fiction, of movies that have all come out since 1982. Okay. Again, with the sequel, I would, you know, they, in this Blade Runner movie, they mention how they're bringing him back to hunt down Nexus replicants, where you're like, ooh, yeah, okay, well, he must have had some history of doing this before. So I'm thinking, instead of doing a sequel, they probably should have done a prequel, you know, with a different actor.
Now, give them time. They'll figure it out.
I know, and show his exploits before then, because there was almost a built-in setup in the original Blade Runner movie for a prequel. You know, this guy's already a hard-boiled, like I said, at the start of this, like he's a hard-boiled detective kind of guy. You're like, oh, this, you know, there's something else had it happened in this guy's life. And maybe, unless he's a replicant and he was just born like a few months before this happened. But anyway, yeah, like I said, it's still a good movie. I just
all right,
a little let down just because of my own, and this, like I said, this is my personal opinion, but I was let down because of what I had been hyped to hearing about this movie for years.
All right, well, fair enough. Well, speaking of, you know, good material and ultimate letdowns. So, you know, Ridley Scott was the director of this, and you know, he had done Alien, and he had done this, and there's a phenomenon in Hollywood that me and Mike find interesting. It's that, you know, when people may have gone too far and they start to slide a little bit. We thought it'd be interesting for our segment. You just made the list, pal. To kind of explore that phenomenon where, you know, these auteurs kind of slide toward mediocrity. I'm not saying that Ridley Scott is mediocre in any way, but his most recent kind of movies don't really kind of hit the mark like they used to. And we wanted to explore some other phenomena like that. So we're running a little bit short on time. So Mike, can you think of a couple examples? Maybe we'll alternate, where people that we used to really think were just top notch that have more recently kind of dabbled in mediocrity.
A few came to mind, and they were, these three particular gentlemen should have been replicants that died in the rain after their peak of their performance, and then they just should have just gone away, right? First one that came to mind was, hey, star of our movie, Harrison Ford. This guy should have, but he should have retired before he reappeared with Shia LaBeouf and Cate Blanchett in a certain, I don't know, reimagination of his Indiana Jones character. He should have turned that role down, I'm saying. Since that point, he's appeared in a couple other movies. But even before then, he was in a couple of clinkers like Firewall, 6 Days, Seven Nights. A real stinker was Cowboys versus Aliens. He should have. I kind of wish he had retired because he is still reappearing. He's reappearing to destroy some of his old iconic characters like the aforementioned Rick Deckard in Blade Runner 2049, which, let's face it, he looked like he was
tired.
Yeah, he was tired. His he was looking for his check to be cashed. Yeah. And the same thing I could say for his Han Solo. And, I think he was probably, and not necessarily in the first of the trilogy, but the third one where he appears as a quote unquote ghost. Another tired performance. So he was the one I would say has delivered us a few clinkers. And, my gosh, there's a TV show called Mosquito Coast that's on now. If he appears in that, I won't be surprised, but I will be very, very sad.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Well, mine hurts a little bit, too. My first choice, it's Bobby D., Robert De Niro.
Ah.
And we talked about this a few times. You know, he was, you know, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, you know, Goodfellas. And then he decided he wanted to play things like, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Oh yeah,
and that what was that terrible movie he did where he worked at Google?
You're right. I don't, you know,
the internship.
Yeah, intern or something. Oh. Like that. Yeah, internship.
But,
oh boy,
and he's been cranking out not good stuff for a while now. And again, I think it goes back to the legacy tarnishing stuff. You know, I don't want to see Robert De Niro trying to be funny with Vince Vaughn.
Yeah.
I want to see him as Raging Bull. That's how I want to remember him.
And then and even when he's like de-aged or shown in that movie, The Irishman, it just doesn't work anymore. You know, it's like,
ooh, well, I'm going to get to that next. So,
okay. I think I know your next one.
All right, Mike, your next one.
Ah, well, this is the gentleman that's been mentioned a couple of times, probably by me, not necessarily in our podcast, but a certain Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
This guy, he was the epitome for me of cool and just a great actor in the 80s and even into the early 90s. Sean Young, who we mentioned in being in Blade Runner, she was with him in one of these movies called No Way Out, which is a fantastic
great movie.
Espionage kind of spy movie. You think of movies like Bull Durham. Oh, I mean, just...
Oh, could be cooler.
Yeah.
Could not be cooler.
Tin Cup, you know, you think of him as the golfer that just doesn't give a shit. Field of Dreams, you know.
Yep.
And then a movie I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago, Revenge, where he's... You know, Madeline Stowe gets murdered and he's like going down to Mexico to get revenge. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Even The Untouchables was
great. Yeah, there you go. It's another one from the early 90s. And since I'm going to say since Dance with Wolves, I know the amount of output is limited, but they're garbage. You think of The Postman and Waterworld and even
Wyatt Earp.
Even his appearance there in the Superman movie. It just is one note is always the same kind of is Kevin Costner being Kevin Costner. And I haven't watched any of the Yellowstone show. Supposedly he's himself again in that movie. But I liked him when he was the cool, more hip kind of Kevin Costner, not the one we see now.
Yep. That's a common thing, unfortunately. And that kind of brings me to my next one. And this, it sounds sacrilegious, but I'm going to say it anyway. Martin Scorsese. He's hand in hand with Robert De Niro and they pretty much work together on everything, but I'm not saying that I wouldn't watch any movie he ever does for the rest of his life. Don't get me wrong, but he had that string of movies that are just probably from Departed and prior, just amazing movies, you know, iconic movies. But then he started doing things like Silence. You remember Silence, Mike? Exactly. Yeah.
Wait, it bombed. Yeah. I knew that.
Yeah. And then like Hugo and Shutter Island even The Irishman doesn't carry the same kind of cachet that the others that movie should have carried. So
The ending of Shutter Island. I just thought of that. Thank you.
Those are kind of, you know, I guess when you hold somebody up to a level of excellence that, you know, they have a lot more to lose when they miss the mark. Maybe that's what's kind of clouding my judgment, but it seems like he hasn't made a really great movie in a very long time, and it's a shame. So I hope he bounces back.
Again,
everybody, these are just personal opinions. The Irishman is not a bad movie, but is it Goodfellas, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver?
No.
Yeah. So, well, Mike, we're kind of running short on time here, and I think the audience is probably running short on patience. So
I got three honorable mentions. More? These are my rapid fire honorable mentions.
All right.
This goes hand in hand with De Niro, Al Pacino.
Okay. Good one.
Rod Stewart. And I'm going to bring him from my music world.
Going out, oh, he's outside the realm.
Mr. Schmaltz. Right. And then anyone from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Those are good.
I'm bringing the full circle.
I was trying to put together a list of people. Like, there's some people that are just bad and always have been bad, you know. It's like that the Seinfeld joke, you know, a pop cart could never go stale because it was never fresh. But I'm thinking people like Bruce Willis, Nick Cage, Vince Vaughn. I don't think they were ever really great, but now what they're doing is absolute trash, but we'll spare them for this episode at least. We'll move on. So
hey, the jury's still out on Nick Cage, man. Come on. He's making it's a mini comeback.
Did you see he's playing Dracula in the new movie Renfield?
Yes.
Ugh,
well,
here we go.
Wait, well, come on, give a chance.
If you can't cash in on iconic fame, what can you cash in? So, all right, so that's going to wrap it up, guys. We really appreciate you guys tuning into us every week, and tell your friends about the show. We would really like to get more people involved in the show. Having a listener sit in and join us last week was really exciting. We'd really love to kind of open up the doors to more people. So if you like the show and you have been listening for some time, tell your friends. You can tell them you can check out our show on Instagram at Grumpy Nostalgia, and you can send us an email at nostalgiagrumps@gmail.com. So, Mike, that's going to wrap it up for this week. If you really are Mike.
I may not be here next podcast. I'm scheduled to retire maybe in a couple of weeks.
All right. Sounds good. So for Mike James, this is Justin, and we will see you again next time.
It's too bad she won't live. But then again, who does?